to call to order this
Did Rep. Graham hear that?
It's February 18th, 2013 meeting of the House Committee on Higher Education and Workforce Development. Welcome, everyone. We are going to go into a work session right away to deal with House Bill 2787. And so let's do that. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2787.
Chair Dambrell, I would like to move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2787.
Okay, Rep. Parker moves the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2787. The motion is not debatable. And let me just clarify for you in the audience, this is for the purpose of substituting one set of amendments with another, which I'll explain in a moment. Is there any objection to the motion?
It's not debatable.
Okay. Seeing no objection, the rules are suspended.
Chair Dambrell, I move we reconsider the vote by which the Dash 10 amendments dated February 14, 2013 were adopted.
Rep. Parker moves to reconsider the vote by which the committee adopted the Dash 10 amendments dated February 14, 2013. Let me step back and
is that debatable?
This is debatable. Yes. And in a moment, I'll ask the question: is there any discussion? But before we do that, I just want to explain. I think I sent an email to you all yesterday explaining this, that as we worked on the amendments on Friday, I think I pointed out that there was one small piece of the Dash 6 amendments that I think we all agreed belonged in the bill, but was not part of the Dash 10s. What that is it has to do with the tax identification number. You'll remember that in the Dash 6s, the wording was a federal individual taxpayer identification number or other official federal identification document. And, you know, the purpose for that being in the Dash 6, I believe, is that things can change, the tax ID program can change, can be dropped, whatever. So this allows us some flexibility as far as that goes. And so that's all that this does. We did manage to receive a fiscal on this, so our voting to approve these amendments does not slow down the process. So any discussion about this change? Okay, seeing none, is there any objection to the motion to substitute, to reconsider, first of all, the Dash 10s?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Rep. Wisnik.
Is the chair still, I think one thing that would make this bill so much better would be to talk about a sunset to be sure what the impact is to our universities and our citizens. Does that mean that since the chair is opening discussion for other amendments, would we, chair, be willing to do other amendments?
Let's take care of this first, and then let's reconsider the Dash 10s, and then we can talk about that. So is there any objection to us reconsidering the vote by which we pass the Dash 10s? Okay, seeing none, the Dash 10s have been reconsidered.
They haven't been reconsidered.
They've been rescinded, I'm sorry.
No, the motion was to reconsider it.
Mm-hmm.
Now we have the ability to reconsider it.
This is right.
Okay, to reconsider, now we can substitute another set of amendments for it.
Yeah, exactly. Can we discuss that?
You can discuss what?
We have a motion on the floor. In order to reconsider, that means we now have a motion on the floor to reconsider. I mean, now we have a motion on the floor to do something else.
Not yet.
I was about to make that motion.
Okay.
For the dash 11s, if that seems appropriate.
Yes, that's okay.
We haven't taken 10 out yet. We now have the opportunity to take 10 out.
No, we have taken 10 out. Taken it out.
Okay, let's stand down a moment. Okay, we are back in session. Rep. Parker?
Chair Demmer, I move to adopt the dash 11 amendments dated February 15th, 2013.
Okay, Rep. Parker moves to adopt the dash 11 amendments dated February 15th, 2013. Any discussion?
Down here, sir.
Yes, Rep. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate adding this phrase in here because I do think it reflects the fluid nature of the whole immigration situation in the states, and I think this opens the door to for this piece of legislation to apply to any other modifications that may come that aren't currently in view. So I think it's a good add. Thank you.
Okay. Any further discussion? Rep. Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and if you can help me or Representative Johnson's comment made me wonder if he could help too. Is this, and I do appreciate your opening up for another idea here, does this help us, by us I mean State of Oregon and employers, so that students that would be eligible for in-state tuition would be more, I don't know how else to say this, more legally employable during their education and then, of course, after? Does this make it more possible for them to sign up, be processed, not have a hang-up if they're in an interview, and say, yeah, looks like you're all set, you can pay taxes, I'm following the federal and state labor laws, welcome to the company?
I would say that what's in view here in this amendment doesn't change the current status that exists. I think this just recognizes that there could be changes to come within the near future that would change the dynamics of that situation. I would read back up earlier in that line, just simply stating that the language about a federal tax ID number or an ITIN, I think, does help to illuminate that the fact that, yes, whether they are of legal position or not, they still can have do have the ability to pay taxes at the federal and at the state level. And I think that's the intent behind this, you know, that portion of what was in the dash sixes that I brought forth last week, was just trying to underscore that in addition to asking for the privilege that we're extending to them, that we also ensure that they are, in the eyes of the feds and at the eyes of the state level, tax-paying citizens of record as well. Not citizens, but
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We heard in testimony the other day, I believe from the immigration attorneys, that there's a different path toward a work permit, and I'm going to get it wrong, but it's something like IS 766 or close enough, give or take a digit or two. So there is a work permit that they can apply for the federal government. The ITIN gives them the ability to be federally recognized to pay income taxes.
Okay, further discussion. Okay, seeing none, is there any objection to us moving the dash 11 amendments? Okay, seeing none, The dash 11 amendments are adopted. Okay, I want to give Rep. Wisnant a moment now. Rep, let me say, you know, offhand that, firsthand that, my preference would be that the issue that you're raising be taken up over on the Senate side. And, you know, I say that because, you know, it's coming to us at this point. We would then have to get a fiscal on it and, you know, et cetera. And, you know, I think that's an issue that's, you know, worthy of conversation, but there is time in the process to do that. So. Okay.
Mr. Chair, should we let Rep. Wisnant?
I didn't make a motion.
You didn't? Okay, fine. Alrighty. Mr. Chair. Chair Denver, I move HB 2787 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Rep. Huffman moves House Bill 2787 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Rep. Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you know, there was, and it doesn't really matter, but there was talk in the building that this might be, you know, one of the first times when people of a certain party felt they weren't being heard by another party. And I just wanted to say that I thank you very much for the way you conducted the meeting. I may not agree, but I appreciate what you did here this morning, and I appreciate the chance to speak. I can't support the bill, and it's not because of the testimony that we heard, particularly from students. I would comment now before the bill goes out, and this is not directed at you, Mr. Chair, or anybody on this dais, but I was disappointed, to say the least, in some of the comments, not by students, but by our colleagues in testimony, to raise the emotional debate. I thought that was inappropriate. Words about patriotism and so forth, I thought had no place in a committee being conducted the way you conducted it. That being said, there's sufficient questions in my mind of why we're moving so quick when the President and the Congress are so active on issues related to this. I think it's easy to kick the can down the road and say, well, let's just see what they say. But with so much activity in Washington, including this morning, if you heard news reports, I think it would be wise to wait. We're not. I'm still not clear about how we move, and the subject of our committee is higher education and workforce development. And I think you have driven a lot of that workforce development. The connection is fuzzy. Maybe it's just me and my inexperience. I don't have a small business. There's been a lot of, I'll say, pushback or concerns since our hearings from small business in my community saying, you don't understand what kind of pressure I'm under when somebody comes and is not documented or somebody doesn't have proper documents. So it's still a little fuzzy to me how you get the tuition, get your degree, and then easily get hired in this state. It's hard enough to get a job, but there are other issues, as you know. So I'm concerned about that. The last thing that I guess I'll say is that it's important. Process and is very important. It has nothing to do with punishing students. But how we do this is important. And one of my most dreaded phrases is one you just used. We'll fix it on the Senate side. And so I would plea with you to do more than just say that today, because getting them to fix it on the Senate side, getting them to listen to the issues is extremely important. And you have the best chair to explain our concerns and to advocate for them doing more work on the Senate. I don't want to just see this go out. I think the concerns that have been mentioned here are valid ones. And with that, I'll stop and thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Rep. Gilliam. Rep. Greenlick.
Yes, Mr. Chair. My comment has just slightly changed now. I need to respond. I remember hearing a real stupid story about a snail and a slug that were in a bar, and something happened. The police came to question him, and they said, oh, that just happened so fast, I can't possibly tell you what I observed. The point I did want to make is I'm the only one on the panel who was here in 2003. when we started and failed this. And if a decade working on a bill is too slow for my colleague, I'm glad he's going to be around for a long time more to catch up with other things. This has been excruciating.
Mr. Chair,
slow.
Inappropriate.
And I just...
That's it.
I'm glad we're finally going to have the opportunity.
Don, that's inappropriate to talk about.
I'm sorry if... Representative Gilliam, if I offended you.
Was that a snail or slug?
I was about to slug that. But I think it's what... Representative Wizard bet. It's a serious comment. It's not. I didn't mean to make light of it. We have been working, and this has been a painful journey to get to where we get. And I'm glad I'm still alive to be here to observe it. Thank you.
Thank you, Rep. Gomek.
Rep. Huffman. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is more for future comments before this, and I think every legislative committee, and that's encouraging everybody that comes before the body to testify, tell the truth and the whole truth. And when we're up here asking questions of people that are here to testify, you know, if you recall, I ask a number of very direct questions of university presidents and a number of people that came to testify. And then after the hearing, I would have people contact me and say, well, you aren't given the truth. All we can do up here is spend our entire weekend investigating topics, and then when we come before you guys and people come before us to testify and we ask them questions and we get responses on the record, at some point we have to say, okay, we've heard the truth. We've heard clarification. We heard it. I asked questions out of the immigration attorneys, the university presidents, Jake Kenton, on and on and on, asking very direct questions. I have to assume that we're getting accurate information back. And it does not help the process when people circle back around and say, well, you didn't hear the truth. I ask for the truth. I assume I get the truth. And I will shut up there because I could keep going. But, you know, I just want to encourage everybody, yeah, state the facts. And, you know, if you send out emails after the hearing and choose not to use the information that was used in the hearing, then I guess that's up to you. One of the reasons I became a chief sponsor of this bill this session was to help in the messaging and stick to the facts and disseminate the truth. And I've done that to the absolute best of my ability. So, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thanks, Rep. Huffman. Further comment?
What are they talking about, John? Processes?
Yeah. For example.
Okay. Seeing none, let me just make a couple of final points. Actually, just first of all, just directly to respond to Rep. Gilliam, and I hope to explain why we're moving this bill at the beginning of this session. You know, the hope is that this bill will pass and that tuition equity will be a policy that will go to the universities then to do some rulemaking around so that it can be a program that's available in the next academic year, starting at the end of the summer. And the sooner that we can get that process going, the more the students who are currently high school seniors or in a position to be able to take advantage of it next year can. So again, we don't lose a year. I appreciate Rep. Gilliam's optimism about the federal comprehensive immigration reform. I hope we get there. I'm speaking personally here. But you know, this has been a long, complicated struggle, and I don't think we have guarantees that the whole picture will be resolved this year. I do think that, you know, one area where most people in the country have agreement around, it is this issue of young people who have grown up in this country and who are seeking to, you know, to better themselves and to access higher education. That piece of the federal conversation known as the DREAM Act, I think if people agree on anything, it's going to be there. And, you know, one element of the DREAM Act that you may not know is that even if the DREAM Act were to pass, or a comprehensive immigration reform that incorporated the DREAM Act were to pass, the decision of states doing tuition equity, that is a state-by-state decision. We have to pass that as a state, if we agree with it as a state. And so for us to have this program in place will prepare us for, you know, that day, which I hope will come, when tuition equity will be part of a much larger comprehensive immigration pattern. The issue of the sunset, you know, I just, in full candor, Ripken, I have to say that I don't support that, you know, personally. But it is an issue that can be taken up in the Senate. I say I don't support it because I don't think it's necessary. I understand the caution that inhabits the motivation to do that. But, you know, I don't think it's necessary. So I just, in closing, I want to thank you all, colleagues, for your attention during these, you know, very difficult, you know, I think emotional and polarizing at times conversations around this issue. You know, I'm proud of the way that we've handled it, and, you know, I look forward to us moving on to, you know, the other work that we have to do, all of which, though, you know, is related to those core issues of access and inclusion and affordability and success. And so with that, I think we're ready to vote. Cassie, would you call the roll, please?
Representative
Bagel? Aye.
Representative Gilliam?
No.
Representative Gorsuch?
Aye.
Representative Greenlee?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative
Whitford?
Nay.
Vice Chair Harper?
Aye.
Vice Chair Huffman?
Aye.
Chair
Dembrough? Aye. The motion carries, and the bill will be sent to the floor. I'll carry it. So with that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2787. We're going to go to the... Okay, we're going to go out of order a little bit. I think it's time for us to deal with pesticides. Okay, that seems the most appropriate next.
It's okay to be out of order.
Is that it? 2621. Okay, so I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2621. And Victoria, would you please explain this bill to us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2621 exempts from integrated pest management plan restrictions pesticides used at community colleges for scientific research or academic instruction, declares emergency effective on passage.
Okay. I'm going to call up, to help us understand what the issues are here, I'm going to call up John Wyckoff from the Oregon Community College Association and Johnny Mack from Chemeketa Community College. And... for those of you who were on the committee 2 years ago, I guess maybe just Reps Johnson and Harker, think students using wine in their courses or alcohol in their courses, and I think you'll probably understand what this bill is about. Mr. Wyckoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Wyckoff, Legislative Director for the Oregon Community College Association, and I come to speak in favor of House Bill 2621 today. And with me is also Johnny Mack, Executive Dean of Career and Technical Programs from Chemeketa, who will be able to get into some of the details of how this works on campus. Essentially, what House Bill 2621 does is create a very narrow exception that was really an oversight in the original legislation. What the bill did was ask every college, university, and K-12 district to create an integrated pest management plan for buildings and grounds with a list of I believe, safer pesticides that could be used for campuses and grounds. For the universities, there was an exception for especially ag extension programs where the safe use of pesticides is taught as a part of these programs. Those agricultural pesticides would be different from those allowed for buildings and grounds. For the community colleges, this is an issue in our viticulture or winemaking programs, which were not included. So we did not have the same sort of exception for academic programs that the universities had. And all this bill does is remedy that. We worked with the Oregon Environmental Council, who originally advocated the bill, to make sure that they were comfortable with this change, and they are. It's a very narrow, specific exception just for academic programs. It does not change what we'd be doing on the grounds and buildings, and we support that as it is. The other thing it does is the legislation asks the college boards to adopt integrated pest management plans. This simply changes it to ask the college to adopt the plan. This is actually something that we're looking to do in several areas where our college boards have been asked to do fairly specific policies that could be easily done at the college level, and our boards like integrated pest management, I think, as much as the next guy, but have asked that maybe that be done by college administrators and that they don't need to deal with that necessarily at the board level. It still demands that it be done, that the college do this plan, so it doesn't change anything except that they don't have to deal with it necessarily at the board level, but the college administrators would be responsible for making sure that there's a plan that follows the law. And with that, I will take any questions and turn it over to my colleague.
Why don't we hear from you, Johnny, first, and tell us about the program and the way that you teach pesticide management.
Yeah. Chair Denbrough and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Johnny Mack, Executive Dean of Career and Technical Education Programs at Shemecula Community College, and I'd like to thank you in advance for hearing us today. We fully support the IPM plans, with the exception where it relates to our agricultural programs, both in horticulture and viticulture, where not only do we use some of these pesticides to harvest our crops and stuff, but we also need to teach them so the students are successful in the field when they're dealing with horticulture crops and viticulture crops, as well as other farm business practices. One of the things I really, really want to stress is throughout the entire curriculum, we integrate environmental safe practices. For example, our vineyard up in Eola is safe certified and life certified. And we really, really stress that. And we're using alternative practices in the greenhouses, for example, purchasing ladybugs to manage some of the pests and stuff that are also in there. So the environment is important for us, but we also, with the list of pesticides and stuff that were sent out on the original bill, it really limits us in what we can teach and practice in the field to make our crops a viable crop.
Okay, thank you. Any questions, colleagues? Yes, Rep. Gilliam and Rep. Wisnant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before Representative Greenlake asks, does this affect snails and slugs at all? Okay, that's all I got.
Chair Denver, one would hope.
Rep. Wisnant, please follow up on that one.
No, Mr. Chair, I'll go ahead. When I was asking the office, we talked about vineyards, and I said, sure, of course. How about my Central Oregon hops industry? Will they be able to use the pesticides and hops for hops too?
Chair Denver, Representative Wisnett, it means that for academic programs, you would be able to use them in the context of an academic program, but it would revert to the original integrated pest management plan for buildings and grounds.
Thank you.
And the purpose, if I'm not mistaken, is to make sure that pesticides are used responsibly, right?
Correct. and to limit the exposure of people, like, you know, when they're laying in or sitting in the courtyard and stuff like that on the campuses and stuff, and protect younger children. So we fully support that. It's just that we need to have this for agricultural programs.
Thank you. Rick Greenlick.
Yeah, the West Salem Center is your center, isn't it?
Yes.
I just recommend to my colleagues, if you haven't been out to the Viticulture Center and across the bridge, it's really quite an extraordinary. Yeah.
It's gorgeous.
Size. Yeah, I certainly support it.
Thank you.
Pleasure sales aside.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you both for coming. Is there anyone here who would like to? Anyone else here who would like to speak to this bill? Okay. Seeing none, then I'll close the information hearing on House Bill 2621, and we'll get a work session scheduled as soon as we can. Okay. All right. With that, I am going to open concurrent public hearings on House Bill 2537 and House Bill 2647. These bills are similar, I think, in their goals, despite one of them being sponsored by me and the other being sponsored by Rep. Johnson, and unbeknownst to one another. To each other, but that they have to do with that general issue of affordability and transparency, and somehow getting on top of the problem of student debt. So, with that, Victoria, would you tell us what each of them is?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2647 requires the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to maintain a list of degree and certificate programs at institutions of higher education, comparing costs and loan default rates for each program, directs the institutions to provide comparative data regarding student loans prior to receipt of the loan. House Bill 2537 requires institutions of higher education to maintain lists of degree and certificate programs that compare costs for each and average salary earned by recent graduates in common positions of employment.
Okay. Rep. Johnson, do you want to say anything about your bill?
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chair. To sum up my thoughts in having this piece of this legislative concept drafted, I guess there's two words that would come to mind, transparency and focus. I think we've all perhaps heard or been aware of instances where, obviously, we've heard it in front of this committee on many occasions, talking about the debt load that college graduates leave their institutions with, and obviously entering into a job market that is as ours is, that can be problematic sometimes when it takes some period of time to find a job within your field, but more importantly to find a job that enables you then to be able to have a likelihood of paying off the debt that you incur during your college career, whether that's 2 years or four. Part of what I think is lacking in the system as it exists today is simply a little additional transparency in that if we look at our students or potential students as consumers, we know that throughout the rest of our society there are all sorts of consumer protections built in, mortgage protections. You know, when you go to sign on the dotted line to buy a house, it's clearly laid out what your payment structure is going to be, how long you're going to be paying on this, what kind of debt load it is, how much interest is incurred in this, and so forth. You buy a car, you have similar sorts of disclaimers. We don't really have that within higher ed, and I'm just suggesting in this piece of legislation that it would be good for us to also have some sort of truth in, not just necessarily lending, but truth in degree acquisition, so that students and their families, at the point in time that they're trying to make a decision about what's the best course, what's the best location for them to pursue regarding their ambitions for degree acquisition or for knowledge to be gained, to know that when you finish your course of studies, what are you likely to owe? And is this, in fact, the right institution? And are you, in fact, on a course of study or degree knowledge acquisition that's going to enable you to have a high likelihood of paying off this debt that you incur over the course of your career? So that would be number one in terms of transparency, just laying it out there and saying, you know what, if you you're going to go down this degree path. This is what it's likely to cost you at the end of 4 years, all things remaining equal. Your need for support or whatever is going to remain about the same, and the support available for you at the end of the day, this is what you might end up owing. But secondly, focus. Having that discussion, I think, will also help to focus the student and their parents and whomever else they seek advice from about simply asking, is this the right institution? Oftentimes we can, you know, in a competitive marketplace, students can be attracted to institutions because nice place, nice climate, boy-girl ratio is good, you know, all kinds of things pop into the equation that might not have a lot
surfing.
To, there you go, yeah. That might not necessarily be driven towards what's the best institution, the most bang for the buck, so to speak, to be able to allow them to accomplish their goals. And I think that also is a discussion that is lacking, I think, sometimes in that determination about what is the best path for me to take as I move on with my life and try to acquire the education that I need to fulfill that. So it's intent. This bill would be intended to become a dialogue starter, if you will. Recognizing that there will be those, I'm sure I've already heard from some of them, within our higher ed institutions who say they're not equipped to do this, and I understand that. This would be a reach. They currently don't compile this data. But I do think it would help us to at least have some substantive discussions this session about this issue, Mr. Chair, and I know that you share some of the same ideas. So with that, I'll kick it to you.
Yes, thank you, Rep. Johnson. I really don't have much to add to that. I think you presented it very clearly. The one piece that my bill adds to it is it puts a particular focus on default rates in, you know, at the different schools. We have the default rates for the Oregon University system institution by institution. At this point, they're not able to look at particular majors and look at, so what's the likelihood of defaulting, you know, with that major? Actually, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, and you may be surprised to hear this, but I think that the field nationally that's most prone to default is business administration. At some point, I think we'll be able to get that information, and it will be useful to students. Default is a very serious kind of situation for students. You know, student debt is the one kind of debt that a person can't declare bankruptcy on, and so it's something that you carry for life. Ultimately, so it is a serious problem. Let me just say that this area is another where my intention would be to set up a work group to look at, you know, how could these goals be implemented? I think that, you know, as Rep. Johnson said, it may be a stretch at this point for the Office of Degree Authorization, say, to be collecting this information. But, you know, I think it would be useful for us to meet, and perhaps Rep. Johnson and I could both be involved in that work group to meet with professionals in the sectors. You know, and I would think, you know, here we're talking about in the world of the public colleges and universities, the for-profit colleges and universities, and the nonprofit colleges and universities, to see just what we can do. I know that the Office of Degree Authorization has a long-term goal of having a website where a lot of this information would be easily accessible to students and their parents, where they could see this kind of information, as well as you know, the extent to which you know, programs are accredited, you know, are the credits transferable, you know, those issues that we talked about last week as concerns. So with that, we have a few people, you know, that I think can speak to this from the real world. And so I'd like to call up Bridget Burns and Jessica Adamson. And is John Wyckoff still here?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative, sorry.
Did either you or the chair or Representative Johnson, did you investigate whether there's private companies providing this information? maybe our panel can address.
Yeah, perhaps.
That.
I don't know of that.
I would think I'm not aware.
Oh yeah, it was Rep. Parker brought this up last week, right?
Yeah, it did. I would think that this is the kind of thing. There's certainly a lot of interest in it, Mr. Chair, and I would think that the onus should not be on the institutions to provide this. The student organizations or somebody in the private sector or not-for-profit sector would be all over this kind of thing because of how big and a widespread and important issue it is. But let's see what these folks have to say.
Yeah, well, I do think that the institutions will still have to provide the information. It's who collects it and aggregates
yeah,
it
responsibility
and makes it available.
Right.
Yeah, and let me say, I have, so we know, for example, in the for-profit sector that nationally the default rate is 22 or 23%, so almost one in four. But is that true for Oregon? We don't know that. So I've asked the Office of Degree Authorization to try to get that information, and I have that. I believe they have been reaching out to the individual institutions to see, you know, are we typical or, you know, are we better than that? So, Jessica, you want to start since I've just led up to that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Jessica Adamson. I'm here today on the behalf of the Northwest Career College Federation. Thank you for the opportunity to share our thoughts. As you noted, Mr. Chair, the career college sector provides a great deal of information already along these metrics. There's national reporting guidelines that we're already subject to. So this legislation, this additional transparency is nothing new for our sector. We're here to just respectfully request to be part of the work group to try and make sure that the information reporting is similar, so we're not doing it two or three different ways, but that we can kind of make it similar to what we're already doing. The Office of Degree Authorization has indeed recently reached out to our member institutions, all of which have provided that information back to ODA on state default rates. I have not seen that report yet. We're obviously interested in it as well.
Thank you, Jessica. Ms. Burns.
Chair Dembo, members of the committee, for the record, Bridget Burns, Chief of Staff for the Oregon University System. I just have a few comments to offer on behalf of both of these pieces of legislation, mainly some questions and our support for the creation of a work group. We are really enthusiastically supportive of the idea of providing more information both to prospective students and our students and also to the legislature because we believe we have a great story to tell about our students and how productive they are and how they are employed and doing great work out in society. So we would be supportive of the creation of a work group, and we would ask that you would probably want to connect with the conversations that are ongoing about the creation of achievement compacts pertaining to employer satisfaction. We've already been engaged in conversations about how we can best measure not just how employed our students are and in what fields, but also how satisfied their employers are with their performance and whether or not what we're providing is exactly what we offered. So I would flag that piece, and then I would indicate that there are three areas for clarification on House Bill 2537 that would be helpful for us as you engage in this conversation with the work group. The first of which is what you mean by degree type. Are we talking about specifically just bachelor's versus master's, or are we talking about a sociology degree versus an engineering degree? So a little bit more clarification is helpful. Second, what do you mean by recent? In the past, we used to do a survey at the Chancellor's office called Where Have All Our Graduates Gone? As a result of budget cuts, we were no longer able to provide that survey, but we are very interested in doing it again. Some of our institutions already do some of this survey work, so it will be a matter of compiling it. For instance, OIT has a great story to tell. Their graduates make the most on average of any Oregon University System institution. So they provide this information, and we would just have a process of trying to compile it and develop a meaningful metric. Finally, what is meant by common type of employment? That's going to be important because when you're talking about different types of degrees, there's going to be a wide variety of what would be common employment, particularly when we're talking about liberal arts graduates. I myself have a political science degree. I don't know if that lends itself to me working in higher education necessarily, but I think that you will see that there's a wide variety of fields that folks are employed in, and particularly from the faculty perspective, they don't believe that they are a training recruiting program for jobs, but rather they're about cultivating inquiry and critical thinking and building great citizens who are going to civically participate and engage in society. So it's a bit more broad, and so I think a little bit more definition would be helpful, but ultimately we think it's a conversation we want to have. The other thing I would flag in particular with this legislation would be working to connect it with the work that's ongoing with the President Obama's scorecard, and also Senator Wyden's Know Before You Go Act, which he recently had a press conference last year up in Portland that was widely participated in, and it was a very interesting topic. We know this is a national conversation about the value of degrees, and we are very supportive of engaging in it. Finally, on House Bill 2647, we're supportive. I just wanted to flag that I did some research for you in terms of finding out what is available. And it turns out the federal government will provide this information based on per institution if you ask for it. We have not historically asked for this information, so we are happy to do that. Our financial aid offices can request a report of the default rates based on all of our students, and then we can connect it if we build the right data system. Again, important in the work group to engage on a conversation about how to build that data system that's going to be most helpful to you all. But we would be able to then correlate that information with the data that we can get from the federal government. The one thing I would flag is that you can't get this information for loans that are not federal loans. So I would say that you probably want to engage in a conversation about what are you going to do about for-profit federal or non-federal student loans, because the default rate there is one that should definitely be explored. So with that, I'm happy to answer any further questions, but otherwise we're happy to engage in this conversation and participate in the work group.
Thank you, Bridget. You raised many, many very, very important points. Rep. Parker, you had a question or a comment.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair. As to your request that we be more specific in a few different areas, I have a concern that if we are specific, we will either right away get something wrong or in 2 years the list will be wrong. For instance, a list of common positions of employment. There will be things in 3 years that we can't imagine right now. So if we specify, it will rapidly become outdated or inappropriate in some other way. So we have to walk that line. I understand what you're asking for, to give institutions some clarity about the reporting, but we have to be careful that we don't create another problem while trying to solve this one.
Chair Demo, Representative Harker, I agree with you, and I would just point out that what I mean is how you assemble this work group is going to be important. I would indicate that if you bring in folks who work on this kind of data and who build complicated quantitative data systems, they will be able to help you be able to define and parametricize the information so that you're getting long-term what you're looking for. So we have folks at the Chancellor's office who do institutional research that would be able to help you develop a data system that would long-term make sense in terms of the methodology. That's all I would flag, is that how you define it from the beginning, you can be very specific. We could develop a system that would work for you. It's just a matter of a little bit more detail might be helpful, and perhaps having those folks at the table will ensure that we have the appropriate outcome.
Be sure the task force has the ability to produce that parametricization then.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Gillen, did you have a question?
Just a quick question. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Could you be more specific about the kinds of loans you were talking about that wouldn't be reported or wouldn't have the kind of data, I should say?
Chair Dempo, Representative Gilliam. So anything that's going to be through the federal financial aid system that are provided by the government, we're talking about Perkins loans, I'm talking about PLUS loans would be related. Yeah, basically, if you fill out a FAFSA and you fill out stuff that's going to be any financial aid that's provided by the federal government that comes in your financial aid package that you don't seek outside, that is provided by a private lender, that's typically what you would describe as those kinds of loans that are. Some indicate there are predatory lenders. There are just private lenders that, for him, you would have a variable rate instead of a set rate while you're in school. So there's a lot of research on this topic. I'm happy to provide you with some additional information. But generally speaking, you're going to know a lot more if the federal government was involved. If students find out if they got the loan support on the side, we probably won't be able to have that information for you. And so figuring out what what detail level is appropriate to expect, and also how we can try and engage in a conversation around those types of loans, because that is a very hot topic in the Chronicle of Higher Education and nationally. We haven't quite figured out how to deal with this.
Thank you. And I would note, Mr. Chair, that her political science degree is at least serving her well today.
How much are you making today, Bridget? No, you don't have to answer that. Jeff Pagos.
Bridget, I'm curious about your comments about faculty, and while I'm all in favor of transparency and support the Denbrough-Johnson proposals, I'm just curious. I mean, I find myself frustrated on this committee just because of the higher ed and workforce, and if I were a university administrator, it's very clear that I'd be concerned about focusing on jobs, job creation, sort of educating toward the workforce. And you raised the point about faculty tending to be concerned about critical thinking and creating an inquisitive mind, those kinds of things. So how would you and maybe other associations, how would you approach that kind of issue or pushback, I think, from liberal arts programs, liberal arts kinds of education programs? That's one question. And the other one is in terms of funding, I would think that parents would really like to fund this study.
Chair Denbrough, Representative Gallegos, I appreciate the questions. I don't know the answer to the second one. The first one, I think, is a provocative topic, that there are a lot of recent publications about this topic, about how higher education over time used to be just about cultivating intellectual inquiry, and over time we have transitioned to more of a training focus. You can see that in the further expansion of things like, for instance, MBAs didn't used to exist, right? It was more about trying to, that was something that you would have practical, real-world experience, and then later, the credentialing was less necessary there. So that's a topic that I would suggest that in order to engage and understand the concerns of faculty, I would bring them in. I would work with the interinstitutional faculty senates. I would work with the faculty senates. I think that they have really important points that we should think about. I think that it would be their priority to focus and make sure that we're not just turning every degree program into a job training program, because we will miss the real reason that higher education was created back centuries ago. It was about cultivating, you know, critical thinkers and a curiosity that has ultimately helped us in society as we've evolved and better understood each other, and it changes your perspective of yourself and the world around you. We believe that what we do is not just make employees. We believe that we are actually making great citizens, and so the complexity there, I think the best way you engage with it is to involve faculty and listen to their concerns, but also they understand. They're super smart people, and they understand the challenge that exists with explaining different types of degree programs and how they're useful after a student uses them once they're graduating.
Follow up.
Okay. Just one last question.
Two comments. One, that I think that a lot of professional schools do report the type of salary, the average salary one would get with that kind of degree. So that information is generally pretty well out there, pretty much. The other observation is, it's actually been commented on one of my colleagues on this committee, that we haven't heard from a lot of teachers and professors and faculty people, so maybe we could do that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Rep. Actually, colleagues, if you'll be patient for a moment, let's hear from Mr. Wyckoff, and then you all can unload on him as well.
Right. Chair Denbrough, members of the committee, for the record, again, my name is John Wyckoff from the Oregon Community College Association. I will be brief in that I agree with what both of my colleagues have just said. I think it's worth noting that, I mean, one of the things that we saw throughout the last recession as state funding for community colleges, for universities across the country dropped and our enrollment increased, there was great pressure on institutions to raise tuition. And we know costs for our students are getting prohibitively high. And so I think the more information we can give them, good information about the choices they're making, the better our students will be. We know that default rates during this recession peaked. We're seeing them level up nationally, not just here, but in the for-profit, the nonprofit, and the public sector. We saw three-year default rates increase as costs went up and jobs were scarce throughout the recession. That is beginning to level off. That's obviously good news. But again, this is information our students should have. We want to make sure that we are also capturing information and data that is currently being collected to the greatest degree possible and make sure that both of these pieces of legislation ask for the agencies or institutions that are actually collecting the data to be tasked with doing so, and that we aren't asking to sort of reinvent a wheel that might already be there. The employment department should probably be a part of this. I mean, for example, we may want to look at, they currently collect high demand jobs by region. That's the kind of information that could be useful to the concepts that you're looking at. And again, as my colleague from OUS pointed out, the federal government is currently looking at, has information about three-year default rates by institution. So we look forward to being part of the work group and trying to make sure that we are aligning information that is already being collected to the greatest degree possible, so that we aren't asking maybe a college or the Student Assistance Commission or somebody who may or may not have the capacity or may not be the right person or the right agency to collect the information. We'd just like to make sure that is done as smoothly and efficiently as possible.
Okay, thank you, John. And just before I turn it over to my colleagues, within the community college sector and I think the for-profit sector, there are a number of programs that really are professional, they're similar to what Representative Gallegos referred to as professional programs, where, they're in many cases short-term, focused on, dental hygiene or, some kind of field like that. And there, I know that the individual colleges, in their marketing brochures, they do talk about, what the average wage is, the expected wage of a graduate in their program. Are those data consistent? If you were to look at a dental assistant, say you want to go into dental assisting, and you would look at a brochure from Chemeketa Community College, you would look at a brochure for Portland Community College, would the anticipated earnings capacity for that field be the same in their brochures? Do we have consistency there? Do you know, or is this more kind of regional? This is how much somebody could expect in this region?
Chair Denbrough, there are going to be regional differences, and quite honestly, where each marketing, marketing person at where each marketing person at a college might be getting that information at each of our 17 colleges. I don't have the answer at my fingertips. A lot of that is going to come from, I would guess, the employment department, where they're really looking at it by industry. Mm-hmm. Which is, I think, the kind of thing that we would want to look at here. But my guess is they're drawing from a variety of sources and trying to get the most accurate information possible. But I don't know that they would all be exactly the same sources. But my guess is a lot of it comes from the employment department, and I can definitely get back to you.
Okay, great. Thank you. Okay, Rick Wisner. You've been waiting very patiently.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to endorse both bills. I think this is valuable information. I would want to be sure that the work group looks at what Representative Johnson asked about as far as, and we just discussed that about salaries, but I'm talking a lot of people now that really try to talk to their children about return on investment and knowing what kind of job opportunities are for each degree, and also with technology changing like it is, that would have to be really current data. Someone at Energy University as a freshman, mm-hmm. by the time they're senior, yeah. the job market and that job opportunity has changed drastically.
Sure.
So, thank you.
Great. Of course,
just to go back to something Representative Harker said, that question of narrowness, there are a lot of jobs that you can get, and you could have had a lot of different majors to get there. And so that could be a particular problem for the committee. In one of the two disciplines that I teach, criminal justice, you can look and see who took criminal justice and then what was the, but you can also take political science, you can take sociology. Most departments don't care what your major was. So I think that is a problem. If we go too narrow, we may miss some of the data.
Thank you. Rip Johnson and Rip Greenwood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
help.
To your earlier point about expected benefits or whatever, you know, I've met with a couple of the different groups from the for-profits who clearly lay out what the expected, let's say, hourly earnings are for some of their certifications, whether it's phlebotomy or whatever, so that those are dental hygienists, whatever. So those students who take on this know what they're likely, what they're very probably will be earning, and then they can talk about their placement rates and so forth. So some are very specific about this. But getting back to Bridget's earlier stellar defense of our liberal arts community and our higher ed system, I too am a political science major, by the way, so you know we shared a bond there. But I do think, you know, as we, I guess for me, and I think for many of us, and I think as it was intended, 40-40-20 is not simply about, is not intended to be simply about the numbers of degrees that are acquired by Oregon graduates. I think we also need to focus on where are those degrees being acquired and what fields, and are they relevant with what our business sector in Oregon need so that we can thrive and we can, you know, exceed and so forth and so on. So, but I think that necessarily is going to drive the discussion about the types of degrees that are being offered by our institutions. And the question becomes, how many more, you know, this is obviously a generalization, but how many more medieval art history majors do we need living in their parents' basements saddled with $80,000, you know, debt when they graduate? And Mr. Wyckoff, who's very professionally attired, by the way, I just wanted to get that on the record, assures me that our community colleges no longer offer underwater basket weaving, which is great. I'm glad to hear that. But we have to focus on, I think, and as we go through this discussion, not just this session, but in many sessions to come, the whole education community is going to need to be focused on purpose, direction, intent, cost-benefit analysis, and I really think that's going to become a part of the discussion. And I recognize that the hallowed halls of academia will, in some areas, be uncomfortable by that. But this type of information is not just relevant here in the higher ed community, but I think this also could inform what happens at the Aspire programs, who are helping to direct kids, high school age and now middle school kids, on a career, on an academic career path that will lead to that career and so forth as well. So it really, I think, can have relevance throughout the whole public education world as we go forward, and I look forward to working with you all in this work group.
Thanks, Rep. Johnson. Do you have a quick response?
I have a quick response, Representative Chair Denbrough, Representative Johnson. I would just add that this is a part of a, this is not just happening here in Oregon. This is a much broader conversation nationally where people are trying to better understand the value of higher education and what degrees are really worth. And I would add that there are other metrics that are meaningful. We know that our graduates civically participate at much higher rates than students who do not have a bachelor's degree. We know that our students give more in philanthropy. We know they vote more. We know that they pay more in taxes. There is a much broader definition of what kinds of how you can determine the value of higher education. So I would just add that we should perhaps engage in the broader national conversation. I think we have tremendous leaders at the university system office. Interim Chancellor Rose is a longtime faculty leader at Portland State who would be very helpful on this topic and could engage in helping us to better define the meaningful value of a degree.
Thank you. And I'll just add that, you know, having worked in the community college sector for many years, I've seen degree and certificate programs come and go. You know, I've seen professions come and go. And I've seen students who, you know, as I think was mentioned, even, you know, soon after they graduated with their certificate or degree in hand, their industry had collapsed, and they had to come back and be retrained, actually. And, you know, and so I think more and more of us recognize that we don't want to be training people for a particular job, but rather be giving them a broad set of skills and understandings, you know, so that they can keep on learning and growing with whatever new industry they become part of. So, you know, it's kind of, you try to find that balance. Rep. Greenlick.
Yeah, I'd like to carry on that point, if I may. I don't think it's simply an issue of the faculty perspectives versus business perspectives. I think it's a question of what we think is the nature of the higher ed system. Is it useful to have certificate programs where people can learn to be a phlebotomist? Absolutely. But when I think back in terms of my career, I think of two things. One is, all my life I knew I wanted to be something, and at the end of the first year of college, I knew I didn't want to be that. and that caused an extraordinary existential crisis in my mind where I mean, I wasted a year. Yeah, I mean, it was really terrible. But I also think about the society, the businesses, the nature of what it was like when I was in university. And there were no jet planes. There were no mobile phones. The high-tech, I think maybe Harkin can remember this, but the high-tech data processing was something called a McBee card, where you punched holes along the end of that card and then stuck a knitting needle in to pull out the cards that that told you what you wanted. I mean, it was a very different world, and if I had been trained to do a job, well, in fact, I was trained to be a pharmacist because I finally decided I might as well get a degree and then figure out what I was going to do with my life. But, I mean, I would have been maltrained for that world. I guess except in pharmacy. Now I'd be making $150,000 a year as a pharmacist. But I think when I first saw the name of this committee being switched from the Committee on Higher Ed to the Higher Ed and Workforce Development, it didn't strike me that we were talking about the nature of a higher ed system that only was related to training the workforce in very specific tasks. I think workforce development means training people so that 25 years from now they'll be well equipped to do whatever jobs there are to be done 25 years from now, not only jobs now. And I think underwater basket weaving has really come back because of the big push on arts and crafts, and I think a certificate in that would probably make somebody very valuable to develop these baskets that now cost $800 in curio shops, especially if it was done underwater.
Mr. Wyckoff, you want to speak to basket weaving?
I did, just very quickly. The first thing I would say is it is, I think, worth noting, in our current technical programs, when a college is looking to create a new program, local workforce need is one of the first criteria they look at in connecting them. Mm-hmm. And while we do not offer underwater basket weaving, were we to do so, it would be a community ed program and not supported by state dollars. It would be self-supported.
If there was a big industry?
If there were a large industry in it, it would probably not fall under community ed. But I do think it's worth noting, I think it was about 10 years ago, the Oregon legislature stopped funding programs like conversational Spanish, jewelry making, things that that we will have for, a lot of senior citizens who are retired, folks from the community come in and take. We no longer receive state funding for programs like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I will say, just to follow up on that I know it may be hard for you to believe, but as I recall, about 10 or 15 years ago or so, our welding program at Portland Community College was kind of on the skids. There didn't appear to be a real market for welders here locally. And what kept the program going was people who were interested in sculpture, who came in and were taking courses in the afternoon or in the evening on, welding for artistic purposes. The manufacturing market resurged, and now we can't get enough welders. So it's kind of an interesting mix. Okay, are there any other questions about this? Okay. Thank you. You are excused. Thank you all for testifying. You will be contacted about your availability to be part of a work group unless you can find some other individual to take your place. We have another person who signed up to speak, and that's Rebecca Roth, who would like to testify on House Bill 2537. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to speak to either of these bills? If so, just come on up. And as long as you promise to state your name, that's all we need.
Okay, my name is Rebecca Roth. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you, Rebecca.
And Chair Dembro, I'm just trying to learn how to do this. And committee? Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm just a taxpayer, or I'm the one who's in the community and representing that there's small businesses, and we're the ones out working and paying taxes. Okay, so I'm all for transparency too. I think a good place to start would be government. I don't feel like our government is real transparent. And I was really disheartened when you move forward that our universities are going to now possibly have illegal aliens in the universities taking places that our citizens should be in with our limited resources. The question at hand, whether or not we should have a government oversight of the things available and what it's going to cost people, I'd like to encourage you to send that out into the private sector, like was already stated. We don't need to grow government anymore. Government is already growing at tremendous rates here in Oregon and nationally. And it's very distressing to me that we're printing money at the national level. That's paper money. That doesn't have anything behind it. We're closing down our industries here and shipping them over to China. If we can educate all we want and have all kinds of money going into the university system, but if all of our industries have gone to China, we're not going to have any place for people to be employed. And other bills that are before the legislature are distressing to me. If we close down mining in Oregon, that's going to be another industry closed. We need to look at the big picture here, and government is one of the big problems, I think. So, thank you.
Okay, thank you for coming forward, Ms. Roth.
Chair Denbrough and members of the committee, my name is Marcia Kelly, and I'm the public policy advocate for the American Association of University Women. And very quickly, AUW has been interested in the issue of student debt and default. In our current, our fall magazine, which I'll attempt to get copies for you, have two articles regarding that. And to the point of other people working on this, there's an Institute for College Access and Success, which is a nonprofit, and they have a project on student debt, and you can pull up some statistics. So you might want to look out and see what kinds of other research there is out there as well. On a personal note, I'm a liberal arts graduate from across the street. They have a president now who's a liberal arts graduate with a PhD in astrophysics. And so just because you're a liberal arts on the BA level doesn't preclude you from having education that does translate to other things.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Okay. Thank you both. Okay, so with that, I'm going to close this public hearing, concurrent public hearing on House Bill 2537 and House Bill 2647. Colleagues, Wednesday we will be receiving the report from the Secretary of State on the state's GED programs. They've done an audit of it. And I'm also hoping to have some practitioners who will talk to us about what's happening with GEDs, you know, in the colleges, in the schools, even in the prisons, because it's, you know, it is a wide-ranging program.
But at 8:30 start then.
That's not all we'll be doing that day, Rep. Greenlick. But I am pleased to end this hearing early. And I'm not going to say that this will allow us to extend future hearings longer.
God bless you.
So all debt is erased as of this day. With that, we are adjourned.